first of all, let's have a little review. Is there anything that has been covered which has stuck in your mind that you don't have to look in your notebook to recall? Jerry?
Three types of leadership: autocratic, democratic, and personal. That's where we kicked off. Then the two major problems, according to the Air Force study, as to why leaders fail is inability to dope out the situation and motivate others to carry out the proper course of action.
Just to take the proper course of action.
Take the proper course of action. And the second cause of that, somebody help.
Utilize all the resources.
Utilize all the resources available. And then we went back to a definition of leadership as being...
Certain problems, certain needs that are hindering
their spiritual
growth,
the ability to accomplish your objective through other people,
or the efforts of others, is the way we expressed it, yes.
Which can knock a person out of the race.
Okay, anything else?
And we must have these in
anybody?
Well, yesterday we talked about the span of control. And if you have more than six people, well, then it's more than the ordinary man can handle, and less than three doesn't give you enough to do.
Less than three, less than two.
Well, I think three should be the minimum. Two is definitely too many, because you divide your work in half, and then you over-supervise.
We also discussed decision-making that takes primary center around inference and observation. And normally we make it from inference instead of observation, as it should be.
Thank you. Okay, what else?
Every need must be traced down to the root cause of the need.
Social pressure. Moral
Okay.
You ought to repeat that.
Yeah, the four factors that influence a person and can help him or prevent him from making a good decision are social pressure, legality. What was the third one?
Expediency.
Or a moral principle is contained in the Word of God.
And Jim, have you mixed oranges and horses in that? Are three negative and one positive? Or are they just all factors which are neutral?
Social pressure could be good or bad, couldn't it?
Yeah.
How about legalism? Could that be good or bad?
Well, yeah, I flinch at that particular word. Legality or the law, yeah, could be either way.
I helped myself here this morning. Maybe they just wanted to don the feel at home.
In expediency, or from expediency, would come priority, huh?
Yes, I think expediency is mostly a negative factor, but I think it could have a positive factor to it.
Well, with no expediency, there would be no priority.
That's true. So I think both of these are influences, and they can be positive or negative.
But the Word of God can only be a
positive factor.
Positive factor.
Right.
Well, when these were given, not necessarily to us, but when they were listed, this isn't an original list with you, is it?
No.
But when they were listed, they were all three given equal weight. We have of necessity given the last one a positive and an overriding quality, which leadership doesn't necessarily require.
Yes, now this in this book it simply says moral principle. But I would like to translate that into the scriptures for our parts, because that's the source of moral guidance, isn't it? actually, in the illustration that was given, this fellow was depending on the law. That's what he fell back on. Okay. Anything else? A couple other points in my mind we ought to review here.
Yeah, I think we agreed that what you stated, that quality of leadership wasn't determined by the character of the individual, but whether they accomplished the objective.
Okay, what are some attributes that seem to be universal with a person who succeeds? Now, one man may have a fine moral character, and the other guy may have no character, but they both accomplish their mission. But both of them have got some of the same attributes. And what did we think was the paramount attribute?
Conviction.
Okay.
Drive is one of them.
Yes, and conviction often leads to drive or energy. Okay, that was the second one. What was the third one?
Enthusiasm is a factor.
Okay. I think we'd lump that right in there with drive, energy, and enthusiasm. And I had a note here to mention something yesterday that I forgot. In one of Dale Carnegie's books, he makes a statement I'd like to throw out and see whether you receive it or not. He says that fatigue is, in most cases, the result of boredom. Where you get your energy to carry on a task is the adrenaline glands release it if you're enthusiastic about the job. If you're not, your adrenaline glands will not release any energy. Now, Carnegie, in his book, illustrates this by telling about some gal that works in an office. She come drooping home one day after a hard day's work at the office and didn't even have enough energy to fix anything to eat. She just kind of passed out in her chair there. And then the phone rang. And it was a young man calling up, asking her for a date. And she had been very interested in him, but she didn't think she had a chance. But he called her up and asked her to go out that night. And she really came alive. Now, shouldn't normally her response have been, "No, this is great, but I'm just too tired. I couldn't move." You see, fatigue is due in most cases, provided I think that hard physical labor and mental labor and so forth can produce fatigue, but in most cases, it's due to boredom. So the person who's bored with his job will never have much enthusiasm or energy, while a person with great conviction and enjoys his job, he just seems to never run out of energy.
Don't you think it would be actually better stated, Jim, as fatigue is a mental result? Boredom is one factor, but you could be involved in something you would be intensely interested in, but be defeated in it and allow it to become a mental situation and therefore result in fatigue, even though it might be something you're vitally interested in. Now, I realize it says in most cases, but...
I think no matter how enthusiastic you are about a job, whether it's mental or physical, you can get fatigued. But that is not the reason that most people, most of us, are so lazy. It isn't because we've overworked.
Jim, you notice in the meetings that pretty soon after 9 o'clock, they're yawning and wiggling in the chairs and so on. You can just hear it all over the film. And then just as soon as the bell rings, scoot down to the King's Furnace, or what is the King James, see? And the laughter and yakking and enthusiasm and jumping around and clowning like you never heard.
Well, that's just a little something going there at the side. We could discuss that pro or con. We shouldn't be bored sitting up there in a meeting, should we? But... our reaction to something like that is pretty much a measure of our interest. I heard Dr. Logsdon, who used to be the Moody Memorial pastor, one day he was holding a three-day Bible conference in Norfolk, Virginia. And he got up and gave a big pitch on Sunday morning. of how important it was for every one of them to come out every night, those next three nights, to hear these most capable expounders of the word in the nation were going to be available. And after he got through with his pitch, he said, however, I have been in this business long enough to not be greatly surprised if the majority of you do not show up. Because, he said, one conclusion I have reached over the years is that we do, in the final analysis, what we want to do. So the most of you people are interested in television, or you're interested in your lawn, or you're interested in your sleep. And you will have done by next Wednesday night what you want to do. And we'll find out pretty much who's interested in knowing more of the Word of God. I hate to subject myself to this test, but every once in a while I look back over a day to see what I've done and then realize that that has reflected my true interest, what I've done. If you want to do something, you'll find time to do it, won't you? And when you can't find time to do something, the reason you can't is because you didn't want to do it. In most cases. Well, let's go on. In these attributes of a successful leader, what's another one? All right. The man most generally must to have produced in the realm that he's going to lead other people. Okay? Now, this isn't always true, but most generally, if he hasn't produced, he has the potential for producing. Ulysses S. Grant, when he took command of the Union Army, was probably the sloppiest individual that's ever been known in the military. As far as his personal appearance, his personal habits, he was just a sloppy individual. But they put him in this position, and he rose to the occasion and shook off all of his other characteristics. So Lincoln must have seen something in him that other people didn't see. But now, this is the exception. Can't happen. Okay, what else do we have down there?
You had this thing, magnetism, Jim, and I don't know if I really understood that, how we finally defined that.
Well, I think we should have gone back and tied that in with this area of enthusiasm and energy. What we said was that energy releases energy, and that this attracts people. So I think we better cross that out as being something separate, although I did list it separate.
This would fit with the idea that a leader has the ability to captivate the imagination of the minds of his followers, and this same thing would apply back even to the gal and the date situation. I imagine this young fellow had sort of captivated their imagination.
But people gravitate toward something that's moving and somebody that's moving. Okay, and then the last area we discussed was kind of broad and hard to pin down, but I wonder if anybody pins it down, did pin it down in your mind. This was the ability to organize and to control and to regulate and to recruit, to attract, all these words, a band of men or a group of men or a team, and lead them victoriously in the battle.
Would you go over what you just stated now? Organize what?
Somebody can help me state it better. But no man can be successful on his own. This is what we're talking about. So he has to have people that he's recruited to his vision, doesn't he? And he's trained them, he's gotten their loyalty, and then he leads them in the battle. Now, I don't know how we'd express that. Have somebody else help me on that. How would you summarize that concept?
Couldn't we say that Samson was a very good illustration of a person who didn't do this and consequently had a very limited ministry in proportion to his capabilities?
and never thought of in that light, but he sure didn't have a very big following, did he? He depended on his brute strength was his main quality for success, wasn't it? Okay, somebody else state this for us.
Well, the thing we stated yesterday was the ability to implement the proper action with the resources available.
Yes, and that's
and we're talking about the resources available as being the band of men.
Yes, that's the main resource.
So we're trying to find now what is the key to uniting, organizing, and employing this group of men to obtain our objectives.
Well, or to state what this activity is.
Yeah.
Being the area of commanding the loyalty of the men?
That's certainly a factor, isn't it? Otherwise, you get a knife in your back. Well, perhaps we won't try to come up with any new concept then to say that it's just to recruit and train and lead these people into the battle. For our purposes, this is what we're talking about, isn't it? Okay, now let's talk some more on this band of men idea. What is essential if you're going to have high morale and success? What's the key?
Every man's needs have to be met.
Okay. Now, is it your job, the leader's job, to meet all those needs?
Not necessarily. You might employ other means or even get the man himself to meet his needs, which would further increase morale.
But it's the leader's job to be cognizant of what those are and see that something's being done about it. Some provision has been made for the meeting of it. Now, haven't you found us out time and time again that you're depending on somebody to do something and then he doesn't do it? And you find out that his mind was overwhelmed with his wife in the hospital or his children were sick. Now, this doesn't apply to you as single people as much. But this person was totally occupied with something other than the battle, had a need that was unmet. Okay. Now, we want to pursue this a little bit further on this matter of meeting the needs of the band. This is a wonderful little book here by the successor of Hudson Taylor in the time in the mission. He was an old army officer. But for 34 years, he ran the China Inland Mission. And the people who knew him said that he was as cold and reserved as a dead fish in trying to get any personal communication.
Name?
D.E. Host, H-O-S-T-E. Now, it's hard for me to believe that's entirely true. I think he must have had some of these qualities. But I've heard Lauren say that after the war broke out, World War I, the mission found out that they didn't have any record, although they had a record of all the missionaries. They didn't have a record of the families. So they were asked to make a report to the various governments of how many nationals were overseas in China, you know, in different countries, and they didn't know. But Host knew, and he gave them the name of all the children, of all their missionaries from memory, because he prayed for them regularly. He was the only man in the mission that did it. Well, let me read just a couple of paragraphs from here. He says, asks the question, what is the essential difference between false and true Christian leadership? When a man, in virtue of an official position in the church, demands the obedience of another, irrespective of the latter's reason and conscience, this is the spirit of tyranny. Can autocratic leadership exist in Christian circles? But he says this is tyranny. Now he says, when on the other hand, by the exercise of tact and sympathy, by prayer, spiritual power, and sound wisdom, one Christian worker is able to influence and enlighten another, so that the latter, through the medium of his own reason and conscience, is led to alter one course and adopt another. This is true spiritual leadership. So I gather he was very adept at getting people to alter their course so that they abandoned the course they were pursuing and took up another. I think that's very evident in his leadership. But he says it was through the medium of his own reason after he had been influenced and enlightened. Okay, now here he gives the qualifications for leadership in his job. He wrote up his own job description. And this isn't something you can copy, I don't think. My personal judgment, for what it may be worth, is that capacity to appreciate the gifts and powers of widely varying kinds of workers, and then to help them along the lines of their own personalities and working, is the main quality for oversight in a mission like ours. Appreciate the gifts and powers of a widely varying group, and then to help them develop their gifts and powers. That was the main requirement for a job like his. Well, how about your band? Isn't that your main job? Appreciate their gifts and powers, and then help them develop them. Now, he brings out some more very striking things over here. It is to be feared that many whom the Lord would have used in due time in his service have been lost to the church through the failure of those concerned to perceive and appreciate undeveloped possibilities in men, and so being repelled by faults and weaknesses which otherwise sympathetic influence and the spirit of appreciation they would have grown out of. It is possible to become stereotyped, narrow, and critical in our judgment about others, especially the young and immature, and so to fail in one of the most essential qualities of leadership. This, I think, is the most outstanding statement in this book. A good leader recognizes indeed that the possession of one kind of power and gift generally involves lack of some other kinds.
Read that again.
The possession of one gift, one kind of power and gift, generally involves lack of some other kinds. Mr. Taylor was talking about most preachers he knew were not gifted in administration. And he said that God raises up men whose main gift and power is pioneering, but very few of them have the ability to perpetuate what God has led them to pioneer. He gifted them to be a pioneer, not an administrator. So, this is very helpful, I think, to make room for a person that is very gifted in several lines, and you just kind of automatically conclude that when God regulated the genes and the chromosomes to give him a big advantage in this area, he might have subtracted those from another area of his life. Now, I suppose most of you have read this book. Are you familiar with it? Spiritual Clinic, Oswald Sanders. Remember what he says about the conditions of spiritual leadership, which is the same as we're talking about here, personal leadership. Leaders are not made by mere election or appointment. Spiritual authority cannot be conferred by bishops or boards. Spiritual leaders seldom seek place or position. It usually comes unsought to those who by spirituality, character, and ability have proved themselves worthy of it. And then Dave mentioned this verse last night in Jeremiah 45:5. They are men who have mastered Jehovah's counsel to Baruch. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. Samuel Logan Brendel, himself a man of spiritual, singular spiritual power, set forth in oft-quoted words the roads to spiritual authority. It is not won by promotion, but by many tears and confessions of sin, and humblings and heart-searchings and self-surrender, a courageous sacrifice to every idol, a bold, uncomplaining, and uncompromising embracing of the cross. It is not gained by seeking great things for ourselves, but like Paul in counting those things which were gained, lost for Christ. This is a great price, but it must be paid by him who would be a real leader. Not all who seek leadership are prepared to pay such an exactive price. But God's conditions must be complied with in secret before he will honor a man in public. Pretty good paragraph, isn't it? Now, we're going to leave this area and go into four or five practical things in the personal life of a leader. And the first one is how to organize your time. Now, probably you've got yours well organized, but this is a good little book. And I'm going to read to you this account of the $25,000 secret. One day years ago, efficiency expert Ivy Lee was interviewing Charles Schwab, president of Bethlehem Steel Company. Lee outlined his organization's service to Schwab and ended by saying, "With our service, you will know how to manage better." And then there's a profane word in here by Mr. Schwab. He was a great leader, but his character wasn't what some people would like. He said, "I'm not managing as well now as I know how to. We don't need more knowing, but more doing. If you can give us something to pep us up to do the things we already know we ought to do, I'll gladly listen to you and pay you anything within reason you ask." "Fine," answered Lee. "I can give you something in 20 minutes that will step up your doing at least 50%. "Okay," said Schwab, "let's have it. I've got just about that much time before I catch a train." Lee handed Schwab a blank piece of notepaper and said, "Write down the 6 most important tasks you have to do tomorrow and number them in order of their importance. Now put this paper in your pocket, and the first thing tomorrow morning, look at item 1 and start working on it until it is finished. Then tackle item 2 in the same way, then item 3 and so on. Do this until quitting time. Don't be concerned if you've only finished 1 or 2. You would be working on the most important ones. The others can wait. If you can't finish them by this method, you couldn't have done it with any other method either." So at least you have the satisfaction that you've been working on the most important thing. And without some system, you probably wouldn't even have decided which was the most important. Do this every working day. After you've convinced yourself of the value of this system, have your men try it. Try as long as you wish, and then send me a check for what you think it's worth. In a few weeks, Schwab sent Lee a check for $25,000 with the letter saying this lesson was the most profitable he had ever learned. In 5 years, the plant was largely responsible for turning the plan was largely responsible for turning the unknown Bethlehem Steel Company into the biggest independent steel producer in the world, and it helped make Charles Schwab $100 million and the best known steel man in the world. Some people have a reputation for producing, and some don't. And the secret is right here. Because some people constantly are producing in the most important area in which production is needed. Now, I expect that most of us unconsciously work on this plan to a degree. But there are others who are constantly frustrated by the mass of little deals that haven't been done. And in trying to work on these little deals all the time, never produce the most important thing. Now, my priority list changes every day. And I very seldom resume where I left off the day before, because something probably happened during the night to change it. Do you have the satisfaction of completing the three or four most important things that are confronting you every day? Or just for personal satisfaction, do you fool around in these details that are kind of bothering you? I was talking to one of our staff members not long ago that's been with us for a long time. And how can I tell this without revealing who it is? But this particular person knows of projects that Dawson Trotman mentioned that he wanted to do and never did. He never did get them done. So this person has built on this unfinished list. I got about 20 years this side. And spends quite a bit of time, you know, trying to get all this up to date. We can spend our time in details that are second, third, and fourth rate because we can't do everything. Every once in a while, my wife tells me when she gets a little overworked, she says, "Well, I can't do everything." And I remind her, I said, "That's probably the most important observation that you've ever made." Right there. So let's, right now, just make a deal that you're going to stop trying. Now, I don't think she really believes that. I think she thinks she can do everything. But if I could ever get her to believe that she couldn't, then we'd say, "Well, how much can I do?" "Well, probably only about 10% of it." "Okay, then let's work on this 10% and forget about this." The other percent, brainwashed out. Okay, is there any comment on this $25,000 secret?
Who's this put out by and where from?
Well, this is a little program. I think in a moment of weakness one day, a postcard came to me and I signed it and let them send this to me. No money down and so forth. This is called the Personal Success Program. And I think it costs about $15. And for the whole course. And they send you a book a month. The one is How to Remember Names, How to Improve Your Memory. But this is by far the most valuable book in the series of 10 or 12 called How to Organize Your Time. And it's, I don't think you can buy it apart from the course, Personal Success Program, Nelson Doubleday. He reduces everything here to a card system, a great believer in cards. In fact, in How to Remember Names, he gives you about 15 or 20 portraits of people you never knew. And you have to carry them around in your pocket until you memorize the names of all those faces. So there's a set of TMS cards in all these books. Yeah.
Ties back to the comment on boredom and partially what you're getting here on time, but the statement, someone made the statement that there's nothing so fatiguing as the eternal hanging on of an uncompleted task. And this I'll buy.
Okay. What are you supposed to do about these things? Now, how much of your energy is spent worrying about things that you feel like you ought to do and wish you had done but never did and probably never will? Anybody want to comment on this?
Comment or confess?
In The Company That Committed, Trueblood makes a statement, I think you probably read the thing, where he found that the only way he could actually control his time was the same way. He'd take his calendar pad and just list his whole day, what had to be done, and unless he felt that something had to come into it, he stuck to that particular schedule, and this way he accomplished what he thought he should.
I personally find that this is very relaxing, and that interruptions don't bother you, because you know that I know I'm going to work on all three to five things. But the way things run, now I don't call them interruptions, but things come up that weren't in my schedule. But I know that I'm going to give full time to this so-called interruption, and when I get through, I'm going to go back to this. Now, if I said that I've got to complete all this today, and if I have to spend an hour with this person, then I'll have to work till midnight. That'd be a little frustrating. But I know. I know about how much productive time I'm going to put in that day. And I'm a poor example. I shouldn't talk about myself.
Jim, do you think learning to know what priorities are is a big problem with the average person?
Yes, it is. I think that's it exactly. And then having the courage to do what my wife said, but I'm not sure she really believes. And Joyce, I would say that I think the feminine members of the human race have greater difficulties sometimes than the masculine in just what is priority, what has to be done, and what doesn't have to be done.
Yeah, then if we could sell ourselves in our innermost hearts as to what was priority, much of the battle would be won, would it not?
Yes.
For instance, at any given time, my fishing tackle box is in good shape because I took the time to put it in good shape over 2 or 3 years ago, and I've kept it in good shape for 2 or 3 years. And my shotgun's in good shape, because the last time I used it, when I returned home, I immediately wiped it off with, you know, clean rag and dried it out and put it away, and it's real good shape. So the things that I sold on that should be done are at this moment taken care of. The things I actually, my inner heart, I just wish I could do them, but I'm really not sold, I have to admit.
Somebody said a mark of genius is to distinguish between the essential and the pressing.
And the what?
The pressing.
Pressing.
Cyber?
I think one thing in this matter of priority, which for a long time I did not realize, but had to list, was the difference between things to do and people. And when I found that if I could include people as the number one priority, then things to do, the second, third, fourth, and fifth, and so on, it removed a great deal of the problem of being interrupted, because any time someone came to see me or call me, I was immediately shifted to priority number one. The second thing is to help me in analyzing this matter of completing a job or a task. I know for a long time, if I couldn't finish something in the time I had allotted, I sort of condemned myself as being a quitter. And now I feel that, that that's not necessarily so. That what you only do today, even though it might only be half done, isn't necessarily a quitter. In other words, the fact that this priority changed, and the next morning I can set this aside maybe for a week. In fact, oftentimes I find that if I let something simmer for a while, a project that doesn't have a deadline, I come out better with it in the end anyway, rather than crash. Those two things have been helpful to me, analyzing first of all my job, what's number one, the people that didn't.
Okay, now along this line that Bob mentioned here, of people or things, I think the Lord has worked longer in my life on this lesson than any other. And he kept me in a hot spot for about 4 years, once that I finally began to learn this. And the attitude that I finally learned to take was, I would pray at the beginning of the day, as I do every day, that God will not permit any circumstance to come to bear on my life that isn't according to His perfect plan. Now, do you believe in the sovereignty of God, or don't you? I particularly used to pray this for the telephone. Aboard ship, I used to run the post office. 1,500 people. And everybody is interested in getting letters and sending them out. I had office hours, but I did more business outside of office hours than I did during office hours. And so people, no matter where they were on the ship, they wondered whether it was worthwhile to come down and knock on the door to see whether I'd take care of them, so they just pick up the phone, of which there are several hundred. On the ship, you're never more than 25 feet from one. And so this went on, early in the morning till late at night. It interfered with my quiet time, my ministry, everything. I finally came to believe in the sovereignty of God, that nobody could ring that phone unless it was within the realm of His permissive will. And once I learned that, why, it ended a lot of battles. So there's no such thing as interruptions. Now, I think that God does expect us, however, to help Him out sometime with the chronic person who has time on his hands and wants to share his leisure with you. So I think the Lord gives us the privilege of helping Him out sometimes in dealing with this type of person who would utilize our time. Well, so generally, the people and the interruption, so-called, are the priority. And then you work on a project in your spare moments. Warren?
I have a question in the matter of distinguishing priorities with people. Maybe there are people that you know you should make an appointment with, and you need some time, but you don't schedule it right now. Then if you're not careful, the pressing will come in people and will take your time when maybe there's somebody of higher priority, and yet you didn't schedule it because of some project. And how do you balance that?
Now, your situation is different from mine, yours and Jim Wright's and so forth, where everybody wants to see you. Well, I can't answer that personally. Maybe somebody else can. But my rule is, I have got time and will make room for everybody that wants to see me. That's my top priority. So I don't care who it is or what the subject is. I've got time to see them. Now, I may have to wait 2 or 3 days, but sometimes, but I'll see them. And I do this primarily by a scheduling, a minimum of an hour a day and sometimes 2 hours a day for this purpose. And that's in my priority list. And then they fit into this block of time. Jim?
I think I'd like to hear more discussion on this thing Warren brought up. It faces you particularly when, say, there are a number of people that you feel for various reasons you would like to talk to this person, or you feel you should have time with that one. And yet the combination of projects and people who ask to see you or ask for your time consumes the time that there is. Now, how you weigh these?
John, you want to comment on that?
Yes. I don't automatically assume if a person asks, makes a request, that it's the most valid request. I have to get my own leading of the Lord as to what's valid and what isn't valid. Sometimes the physical setup of where we live can help us. For instance, if you start to do some work out here in the dining room, why, obviously, you'll have a lot of interruptions, a lot of people will come and pass the time of day. And I don't answer the phone at our house, largely because of when people call, oh, hey, John's on the phone, so I better pass the time of day and be courteous, when they're probably doing it out of courtesy. So it saves us both time. if I don't answer the phone. If they want to see me, I'm right there, and whoever answers the phone can call. And then when I feel that I have to see people, I schedule the time with the people in advance over the phone. And if projects are demanding, then I remove myself from the normal place and geography where I'm usually stationed, such as I remove myself from the home. And then if someone wants to see me, they can, they're told he's at such and such a place doing thus and so, exactly what I'm doing. If they think it's important enough to interrupt, why, they are surely welcome to call. So it just helps them help me, and helps me help them.
Hey, with Jim, I think by the very nature of your job and Warren's, you have to kind of set up an arbitrary division here, that I've got to allow so many hours a day for a project, and then so much for people, and just kind of shield this project time from the people. I think you've got to arbitrarily do that. Of course, Warren right now, I'm sure he'd rather be spending more time with people than he is this project. But it's got a high priority. Well, I think this will be stimulating. We won't reach any conclusions. But I think you should not treat lightly this $25,000 secret. And if we analyze ourselves here, I think we'll find out that probably 25 to 40% of our potential productive energy is used up in worrying or fretting over the things that we'll never get done. 25 to 40% of your productive effort is just spent worrying about or trying to figure out on something that you'll never do. And the thing to do is forget about it. Around my house, we've got a lot of projects that we need to do, and we'll always have a lot of them. But I don't lose too much time worrying about it, because I know the minute I've got some time, I'm going to work on this. And then I'm going to work on this. And that other thing is so obvious to so many people, that happens to be 7 on my priority list. And when I get the other 6 done, I want to do that. I don't know whether it'll be a month or a year before I get to it. But I know this, I'm not going to worry about it. That the main thing main point I'm trying to make is don't worry about it. Don't consume. Let all your energy be used productively.
Probably a lot of this frustration can come too in wrestling about opposition, in a sense, in our own hearts against whether or not we're in the will of God, like the calling, as someone mentioned, between purely ministry or administrative type of a calling. And, tossing these back and forth, and there's a lot of things that need to be done, and being anxious. There's a place to forget some things if you're not
called. Well, I believe that that's the key exactly. And if you know you're in the will of God, you can take just as much joy in doing administrative things as you can in preaching, or probably more, because it's in many ways more rewarding that this is a very intangible thing where you get up and try to answer a lot of questions that nobody's asked you. And that's mostly what you're doing. Russ?
In closing, I do want to tell Denny to this idea of listening to 6 most important things every day. As he said quite often, he'll take a very small job, a job that doesn't consume much time, as the first job for the morning, because he knows he can accomplish it. It gives him a sense of accomplishment and the correct mental attitude to attack the rest of the jobs. And so I just throw this out as an idea. And sometimes you might want to insert as your first job a small job, is to accomplish something.
And I think this is very valid, and it's scriptural too. The desire accomplished is sweet to the soul. However, I would say the average person, they line up their day's work, and they start with the easiest and they never get to the hardest one. The way to start your day, I should have brought Dale Carnegie's book on this, is lay out the hairiest, toughest one at the top of the list. And if you can get it accomplished, then you've got a lot of momentum to get those others. So I think it's a good thought, Russ. But most people will constantly do the easy ones. I know I've heard Sandy say this. He doesn't mean it. But he says, I don't have in charge of my priorities. He says, I just work on the easy things all the time. I never get the hard ones. My priorities are easy things.
Jim, well, I think there's another factor in there, too, that you have to consider, and that is in your relationship of objectives and priorities is your relationship with people. Something that may be a high priority for you could have a small bearing with other people directly, and yet by your doing some of these little things, it might directly affect them. Of course, then you can say, well, this then should be high priority. So like a difficult problem to tackle, the first isn't always the answer because you have to consider your relationship to others and how it affects their day. So sometimes it's getting the easy things through. I'm primarily thinking of business in this relationship.
Well, most of us are capable of producing a great deal more than we do produce, aren't we? John?
One little crutch that I have found profitable is the business of organization and appointments. Most of our letters are typed by girls who come over to volunteer help. Then if I know if Jan's coming at 6:45, I will have the letters on the tape by 6:45. And if that same evening I have a Bible study schedule, I will have prepared for that and got the letters on the tape and be gone for the Bible study before Jan arrives. Because it's a previous appointment, I just find I do what I have to do. So lining up these little appointments and crutches seems to get things done.
Okay, this is... I've got a book here in which the guy says the purpose of a scaffold or a ladder is to reach heights that you couldn't attain without it. So the... I think this is the purpose of these crutches, is to get heights that we couldn't get without. So they're good. They can turn around. We can become their victim. I'm a member of the official board of our church, and we had our quarterly meeting not too long ago. It's the last one I've attended. And it found out there was no agenda item, no business to be discussed. So we'd come from all over town to it, and somebody said, well, there must be something that we can talk about. You know, that's when you get in a routine of previous scheduled meetings. Jerry?
Question. Have you had any experience either in the service or out with the thing that industry is using so extensively now as far as role playing is concerned?
No, I haven't.
As far as what, Jerry?
Role playing.
Parts, like a play?
Yep.
Role.
This seems to be a real key to developing insight to your reactions to the pressures of people and so on when you're given a certain situation with a background which also gives you an attitude and you play your part, I play mine without you knowing what I was supposed to be. And a lot of times this gives insight as to exactly what's going on. They're using this especially in first line supervisors, human relations courses and things like this. And I'm not saying you should go overboard on it. But just being in a mock situation where you're given an assumed attitude and you'll play it to the hill. And in the process of playing it, you may realize that, hey, this is exactly what I do in another situation. And how we react to criticism, how we react when our position is challenged, how we react when our prestige is challenged, and when our authority is challenged, and the reactions we get out of that. Because we played it out in a role situation, then when we hit the real situation, we have insight and we can make some transfer out of what we got back over here in terms of the basic transfer.
Jim?
Yeah?
I'd like to make one other remark. In regard to the feminine side of this program, I really think I perhaps know more of the priorities, perhaps, than Helen. We talk about them. But once we lay them out, say at the beginning of the week, and she helps me keep my calendar and reminds me, I have speaking engagements, letters to put on the dictaphone belt, Bible studies to prepare for, etc. She helps me at checkpoints to find out if I'm on schedule at this particular point. It's really been tremendous. Like I'm reminded at 10 o'clock in the morning that there's three things I have to do in the afternoon. Well, if I haven't started by 10, I've got to drop what I'm doing and start. Or someone is going to be embarrassed. And of course that deflates my personal pride if I embarrass someone. So this has been a tremendous help as well. Working in a team, having someone to work with you as a checkpoint.
Good. Well, now let's just make one or two remarks on this, then go on to something else here. I had an aunt who had TB and spent the last 3 years of her life in a sanitarium out in California. This while I was in the Navy. So I used to go see her on weekends. And I'd write to her maybe once a week, but she never did write to me. And I asked her one day when I was visiting her, I said, why don't you ever write to me? She said, well, I intended to, and I tried to. But she said, they keep us so busy here that I just can't find time. Now, she was a bed patient. And they had a routine. They woke them up at a certain time. They took their temperature. They changed their bed. They changed their clothes. There was a certain radio program came on. This happened. And lying there flat on her back, she was so busy that she couldn't find time to write a letter. Now, it's pathetic that most of us will develop a non-productive routine so quick and think that we're really busy in here, non-productive. Well, just as a sidelight on this, General Patton said that the average person who thinks that he's in high gear, utilizing every calorie of energy that he's capable of expending, is actually only utilizing 35% of his available energy and potential. And he says the difference between a successful leader and an unsuccessful one is the one who knows how to get that latent 65% into action. Now, that wasn't referring strictly to the leadership deal. But if any of us ever thinks that we're hitting on all 16 cylinders and highly efficient, we've probably got another look coming. Bud Wilkinson, who led the Oklahoma team to such great victories, used to tell his team, he says, now remember, when your brain and your muscles and your cells and your tendons and everything tell you that you are 100% fatigued and that you cannot do anything more, he says, just remember that it's a medically proven fact that you have only utilized 50% of your available energy. He said, now that's true. And he wasn't going to put up with this when a guy knew that he was beaten, whipped, and tired. Well, the other team didn't know that. See, they felt like, when they felt like they were beaten, they were. But Wilkinson would not tolerate that. Now, apparently his teams finally got wise to him on that, but it worked for a long time. Read one more thing, then let's go on to two other things we want to cover here. The chairman of the General Petroleum Company, a man named Minkler, among the men who have seemed to lick the problem, perhaps the champion is President R.L. Minkler of the General Petroleum of Los Angeles. It used to be all you saw of him were the bottoms of his feet. He was on the go so much, a friend recalls. But now you can walk into his office anytime and find him with time on his hands. Minkler made three rules for himself. Here they are. One, every night before he leaves the office, he writes down what he did that day that he will never have to do again. He lists the things he has trained someone else to do.
that the same thing or two things?
That's the same thing. Now, I don't think these other two are too practical, but he says he will never allow anything to be put on his calendar that must be done on a given day. Which means that he would not be a slave to routine so they couldn't handle higher priorities. And the third one is, he will never allow an emergency to arise that demands his presence.